The following episode contains adult subject matter, including sensitive material, and is intended for adult consumption only. It may not be suitable for all audiences. Therefore, discretion is advised. Opinions expressed by the subjects interviewed for this podcast are not representative of the producers of the series. Previously on Son of a Hitman.
We wouldn't be having this conversation if Harrelson was still alive.
Sandra Sue Attaway. She'd been the main witness at Charles Harrelson's trial.
They kept me in the jail there over a period of 4 or 5 days.
You know, was there any pressure from the police?
No, they just told me to tell the truth.
Do you think that Charles Harrelson was involved in the assassination of JFK?
Charles told me that stuff. So he's in with a lot of those folks in the same way that Oswald was.
You know, Chuck had it. Terrible ego, but I thought he was a very nice, pleasant fella, but of course he wasn't hired to kill me.
You know, it's pretty shocking when you say this person did it and I saw him do it and they found him not guilty.
It's June 3rd, 1968. Charles Harrelson's on the road in Kansas City with a condom full of Mexican heroin that he's planning to unload for his buddy, Pete Scamardo. It should bring about $5,000, cash. But before he can sell a stamp bag, he sees police lights in his rearview. The cops have a warrant to search his vehicle. It seems an informant tipped them off about the heroin. While the cops search his car, Harrelson manages to kick his stash into the sewer. $5,000 down the drain. The cops miss the heroin, but what they do find is a 12-gauge sawed-off shotgun in the trunk and a clip in the glove compartment, enough to bring him in on federal weapons charges. Harrelson gets his bail posted that same night. But now, he has a new problem. He owes his buddy Pete Scamardo a favor.
Harrelson's a cold-blooded killer.
Yeah, he was intimidatingly intelligent.
He told me if I left him, he'd find me and kill me.
The Rangers knew Charles was a hitman.
I never did hear of any trouble that he got into.
I thought he was a pretty nice guy. But of course, he wasn't hired to kill me.
Son of a Hitman, Chapter 4, Stoughtonboro.
One thing I like about this is that I actually get to discover some things that I otherwise wouldn't, so it is kind of cool to fill in some blanks, you know?
I'm in Houston, Texas, investigating the three murders Charles Harrelson was charged with, and I'm on the phone right now with his youngest son, Brett. I've just learned about Charles's first alleged murder, the kidnapping and killing of a Houston man named Alan Berg. And what I've got to share with Brett about his father isn't going to be easy.
In your investigation, what else has gone on?
I spoke to a girlfriend of your father's at the time, this woman, Sandra Sue Attaway, who testified against him, and she told this pretty dark story of having basically lured this guy. She told this guy, come meet me at this bar. And your dad forced him into the back of the car, drove out to a remote location, and then Charles shot him.
Well, hold on. Did that woman that this happened with, I mean, obviously telling that story makes her an accomplice.
Yeah.
So did they offer her immunity or something to testify against him, I guess?
They did. Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Wow. I mean, I certainly never disputed with that he was, you know, a murder for hire type person, and that he did that, which is kind of heavy to process that information that your dad was somebody that definitely offed some people. Now, who knows how many? Again, I was never really that close to him, and I lived with him just for a small amount of time when I was 15, and the only one of the three boys that ever lived with him. But the irony of all this is that the murder that put him in prison for life, that I think he probably didn't kill Judge Wood, but I think the state had to find somebody, and I think he would have been the easiest one to convict.
Yeah.
some heavy shit.
I can imagine it's only going to get heavier. I still have questions about who Charles Harrelson was really working for, and whether he could have been involved in the higher profile murders he's been connected to. To try to answer those questions, I want to see if there are any patterns between the first two murders Harrelson was charged with. The second was the 1968 killing of a grain dealer out of Hearne, Texas, named Sam DeGelia. I've reached out to members of Sam DeGelia's family to get their side of the story.
Hi, David.
Yeah.
It's Jason Cavanaugh calling. I'm the guy who's making the podcast.
But they'd rather let sleeping dogs lie.
Talk to my brother and sister, and their mindset is they want everything just to go away and quit bringing up memories.
Without the cooperation of the DeGelia family, I want to see what law enforcement can recall about Charles Harrelson and this murder. That's why I'm meeting with a Texas Ranger in San Antonio who crossed paths with Charles Harrelson a number of times over the years.
What's this guy's name?
It's Gizmo.
Hey, Gizmo.
Beginning in 1970, while Harrelson was incarcerated for the murder of Sam DeGelia. This is Texas Ranger Jack Dean.
I'm Jack Dean. I was a captain of the Texas Rangers 15 years, and I've been shot at and hit and shot at and missed, and I've seen some horrible things over the years.
Jack Dean is a tall, white-haired guy in his early 80s. Despite his age, he carries himself upright like a Texas lawman, and he's still an imposing presence. In his prime, Jack was captain of the Texas Rangers, one of the highest-regarded investigative agencies in the United States.
What were your impressions of him first time?
Charlie? First time I met him, I'm a young ranger, and he's an accused murderer, so we don't have much conversation. As time went by, we got to talk to each other. And anytime you came in to the Edinburgh jail, you're probably going to see Charlie. He was a talker. He liked to talk to anybody and everybody. And of course, he was a con man with personality.
You know, someone told me they thought he was a psychopath.
I don't know if it'd go that far. He had something missing. I don't know enough about psychology and the brain to know, but whatever the button that we have that prevents you from killing people at random, that button was gone on him.
As I sit here in Jack Dean's office, a large Western saddle is propped next to his desk, and Fox News can be heard playing loudly from the other room. I'm struck by the myth of the American cowboy and the way it shaped both Jack Dean and Charles Harrelson. Charles lived his life as the Texas outlaw, while Jack Dean was the Lone Ranger. In some ways, they're two sides of the same coin, and it sounds like maybe Charles got away with a lot as a result, even while he was in jail.
He had money. He always had money. Where in the hell is the money coming from? I had an old boy in jail for something. His sister was coming up and visit him. She'd come up at night. Harrelson paid the jailer a couple hundred bucks. The jailer let her in the cell with Harrelson have sex with him for a little while, you know.
Just to be clear, Jack Dean is talking about another inmate's sister, not Harrelson's own sister.
Money was never a problem, which was always a problem for me because we couldn't figure out where in the hell he'd get in.
Typically, prisoners don't have cash on them in jail. The fact that Charles did suggests that someone was smuggling it into him. And from Jack Dean's stories, it sounds like that's not the only thing that got smuggled in.
Did I tell you about the gun we got out of the cell?
Actually, no, we didn't talk about that.
Okay, I don't know exactly how this all transpired, but I had another old boy up for armed robbery, and me and Pat Ramsey, the chief deputy, and this old boy we had in jail, was telling us about some other robberies or something. And Pat got up and he said, okay, you can take it back. And he started out and he turned around and said, oh, by the way, said, Harrelson's got a gun in his cell. Everybody's eyes got big. And I said, well, you know where he keeps it? And he said, yeah, right by the door, there's a rusted spot in the wall. And he's got it hanging on a string and a paper clip. And I said, how cagey that some buck was. Anyway, and we can see Harrelson looking at us. So anyway, we get him out of the cell and go lock him up someplace else. And then sure enough, right by the door, there's a slit there. There was a 25 automatic hanging on a string with a paperclip on it.
Did he have any ammo in it?
Yeah, well, he's fully loaded, yeah. He was planning on breaking out. Still think the little girl, she snuck it in because they wasn't shaking her down. She was going to get naked anyway.
I could listen to Jack Dean's stories all day, but I want to bring us back to the subject at hand, the murder of Sam DiGilia.
So tell me about Sam DiGilia Jr.
Well, I never knew Sam DiGilia. I knew the family and got to be pretty close with him over the years. I don't know what he's all into, but Sam was a shining star of a pretty prominent family and really nice people, but he didn't deserve what he got.
What Sam DiGilia got was two shots to the back of the head. His body was found in an abandoned shack on a farm in McAllen, Texas.
So Sandra Sue, you knew her from the DiGilia trial, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about her.
Hooked up with Harrelson someplace in Houston. Then we had her in the valley because when he kills Sam DiGilia, and he stripped the gun and threw piece here, piece there, what have you, down the road, and they found a part of the gun. They got the barrel and matched the bullet and traced it back to Vernal, Utah. It's bought a sporting goods store, a gun shop. And so I went and talked to the old boy and said, can you describe the old boy that bought it? And he said, no, so I think he was big and he was from Texas. But I remember that girl in a purple skirt. And he identified Sandra Sue.
This was the very same Sandra Sue Attaway who testified against Harrelson for the murder of Alan Berg. The killing of Sam DiGilia took place just a month after Berg's murder. And Sandra Sue's statement to the Texas Rangers tied Harrelson to both killings. I want to see what, if anything, Sandra Sue can remember about the DiGilia case.
And then, were you familiar with the other murder that he was tried for, Sam DiGilia?
And you want to know what I recall about that?
Yeah, yeah.
Chuck and Jerry started talking about killing this man, Sam DiGilia.
Who was Jerry?
He was a friend of Chuck's. I don't know where or when he met him. And so they took off one day and then went down, and I didn't go. And the only thing I know about it is what I overheard when they were talking or what Chuck told me. And God wanted Chuck Harrelson to kill his partner down around Hearn, Texas. And that's really all I remember.
Sandra Sue's memories today may not be as sharp as they were back in 1969, when she told the Texas Rangers what she could about the DiGilia murder. So I've had my associate producer, Deborah, read Sandra Sue's statement from 1969 aloud for audio purposes.
I had met a man from Hearn, Texas named Pete Scamardo, and Chuck told me that Pete had some business they were discussing. About the same time that Alan was killed, Chuck came home with some white powder packaged in a prophylactic, which he told me was heroin, and that Pete had brought it back from Mexico. Chuck was to try to sell the stuff for Pete, as Chuck had more contacts. Then Chuck told me that there was no place in Houston that he could find to sell the heroin, and that he had gotten the name of a contact in Kansas City. So we went to Kansas City. He told me this was to be a sort of vacation, as I was very upset over the Alan killing. Monday, he said he was going to take care of some business and left for a while with the shotgun in the trunk. About an hour or so later, Chuck called me and said he was in Kansas City jail, charged with suspicion of possession of narcotics, and that I should do what he had told me and to come down there as soon as I could. I got a cab and went down to the police station. I saw Chuck in the jail and some officers talk to me, also some FBI men. I told them that I knew nothing about anything. Chuck was in a room being questioned, and when the officers left us alone for a few minutes, he told me he had dropped the heroin out of his pocket and kicked it under the car he was standing near. We eventually went back to the motel after posting bond, and he called Pete and told him that he had lost his heroin.
I can only assume that Pete Scamardo was not too happy about his $5,000 worth of lost heroin. So who was Pete Scamardo, the man who allegedly hired Harrelson to kill DeGelia? He passed away in 2016, and when I reached out to his surviving family members, they didn't respond. But I did manage to get a hold of a journalist who knows Pete Scamardo's story well.
It's like chains in a domino. If one hadn't been there, then none of the other chains would have fallen through.
This is Michael Volpe. He had a chance to speak to the DeGelia family about this case back in 2015. I'm hoping he can provide further background on Sam DeGelia and Pete Scamardo.
Scamardo and Sam were not best friends, but they'd known each other since they were kids. They were altar boys together, went to Texas A&M together. They were business partners. Initially, Scamardo's in financial trouble, so he comes up with this drug deal.
As I learned from Sandra Sue's police statement, the drug deal didn't go as planned when Harrelson lost the heroin. That's when Scamardo gave Charles the order to resort to Plan B.
He loses the drugs, and that's what Scamardo uses leverage. Because he's like, well, I still need money. Why don't you kill my business partner for me?
Because Scamardo and DeGelia were in business together, they each had a $150,000 life insurance policy on the other. Scamardo stood to make a lot of money on DeGelia's death.
The motive from Scamardo was pretty rock solid. Nobody else gave another motive.
So what was the physical evidence used to tie Charles Harrelson to the contract killing of Sam DeGelia? First, the Texas Rangers found several checks written by Pete Scamardo to Charles Stottenborough, a known alias used by Charles Harrelson at the time. Second, when Harrelson was picked up by the Rangers in Atlanta for the murder of Alan Berg, he was driving Pete Scamardo's car, which Scamardo had reported stolen. Third, the Rangers were able to trace the car used to abduct DeGelia and found it was rented under the name of Jerry O'Brien Watkins. When the Rangers picked up Jerry, he had a story to tell. Watkins died back in 2004, so my producer Alex has read Watkins' police statement for audio purposes.
I'm acquainted with an individual by the name of Charles Harrelson. I first became acquainted with him somewhere between the 12th and 15th of June 1968. I first met him at Lucky Pierre's, a private club in Houston, Texas. He had been introduced to me as Charles Stottenborough, and this was the name by which I knew him during all this time.
As an aside, Charles claimed he chose the name Stottenborough by going through a phone book and picking the longest name he could find.
I saw Charles practically every day, either down at Lucky Pierre's or his apartment, or at my apartment, and we played gin rummy together.
According to Watkins, on July 6th, 1968, Charles convinced him to join on a trip to McAllen, Texas.
Charles told me that he was down here to strum a guy's head. I understood this to mean that he was going to give him a whipping.
According to Jerry Watkins' statement, at around 6 p.m., they picked up Sam DeGelia for a supposed grain deal.
At this time, I was driving. Charles was sitting up front on the right, and Sam was riding in the back seat. When we had gone a short distance, Charles pulled a .25 caliber automatic pistol from his right coat pocket and pointed it at Sam. Charles told him, sit back, goddamn you. Because Sam had been leaning forward while they were discussing prices of grain, shipping costs, and things like that. When Charles did this, Sam suddenly sat back, threw his hands up, and said, what's the matter, my God, what's the matter? Then Charles told him to get down on the floorboard and told him not to do anything foolish and that he did not want to have to kill him. Charles took a piece of nylon fiber rope and proceeded to tie Sam's hands behind his back. During all this time, Charles was talking to Sam, telling him not to do anything stupid, that he did not want to have to hurt him or shoot him, but that he was just going to have to teach him how to keep his nose out of other people's business. I drove on to a shack. Charles told me to stop right there, which I did. He then told Sam to get out of the car, but real careful and not to do anything silly. Charles left the car with Sam, heading towards the shack. At this time, Sam was walking ahead of Charles, and Charles was holding on to the piece of rope and following closely behind. I stayed in the car with the air conditioning on. Right after they entered the shack, I took out a cigarette to light it. When I heard a noise like a small caliber pistol being fired, coming from the direction of the shack. This startled me and I dropped my lighter. By the time I picked it up, I heard another pop similar to the first one. Seconds thereafter, Charles returned to the car, walking rapidly with the gun in his right hand, the rope in his left. He got in the car up front with me and pointed the gun straight at me. As I recall, the first thing he said was something to the effect that he had to shoot him or hit him or something like that. Then he said it was a goddamn good thing that I had stayed still or stayed hooked, or he would have done the same thing to me. And if I ever opened my mouth about what had happened, he would kill me and my wife, if it was the last thing he ever did. He appeared to be in a highly emotional state, which I cannot adequately describe. It did not appear to be what I would call fear, but he was in a state of excitement. He held the pistol in his hand. Then he had calmed down a bit, and he was telling me that he liked me and my wife, and did not want to have to do anything to either of us, just to dummy up and nothing would ever come of it. I was agreeing with him. On the plane going back to Houston, Charles sat down by me and I sat looking out the window. Then he got up and talked to the hostess the rest of the trip. I pretended that I was going to sleep, but I just did that so he didn't sit there and try to talk to me.
Flirting with this flight attendant was a mistake. Months later, during the Texas Rangers investigation, knowing that Charles Harrelson was a notorious womanizer, they went to the airport and sought out any attractive women who might be able to identify Charles Harrelson and Jerry Watkins. Sure enough, this flight attendant was able to ID Harrelson and recounted that he tried to kiss her repeatedly during the flight.
A few days after we returned to Houston, Charles and Sue came to my house. Charles was in a mood to talk about what had happened in the valley. He told me he was going to get $5,000 for having killed Sam DeGilia Jr. and that he would give me some of the money. I told him I didn't want any of it. He told me he was going to get this money from Pete Scamardo, who lived up here in Hearn, as soon as he collected the insurance. He also remarked, "Isn't it hell when your buddy kills you to collect the insurance?"
After hearing Jerry Watkins' account of the murder of Sam DeGilia, it sounds eerily similar to the abduction and murder of Alan Berg. In Jerry's statement, he seems to have painted himself as an innocent bystander, but it's entirely possible that he played a larger role in the murder and cooperated with police in order to get himself a better deal. Jerry Watkins would go on to be a key witness in the trials against Charles Harrelson and Pete Scamardo for the murder of Sam DeGilia. Ultimately, this was the first murder Harrelson would be convicted of, but I think it's important to look into the specifics of the trial and how it all went down to see if the details raise any red flags. For starters, once again, Harrelson was represented by the powerful defense attorney, Percy Foreman. Here again is journalist Michael Volpe, who's familiar with the case.
He hires Percy Foreman. He was a good lawyer just as a lawyer, but what made him extra effective is all of that seedy, unethical stuff. Pulling witnesses, assassinating character, wild speculation, doing anything. It doesn't matter. His belief was, I need to get my client off. Everything else doesn't matter. And that's what he did. I don't know how a guy can go from needing money so he's got to kill a guy to hiring Percy Foreman.
The rumor I found is that Percy Foreman was paid by Harrelson with the Harrelson Family Ranch in Lovelady, Texas. Having visited this ranch myself, I don't think it would cover Foreman's legal fees. It's yet another mystery that remains unsolved.
In the trial, Percy made it seem like Sam DeGilia. was a seedy gambling type, knows a lot of like criminal types. I think Foreman at one point said there's at least 20 people who would want him dead.
This line sound familiar? It's one of the same tactics Percy Foreman used to get Harrelson off in his last trial for the murder of Alan Berg.
The other thing he did is he always pulls a surprise witness. So he had some lady who claimed she, Chuck was with me at some nightclub.
A nightclub singer named Louise Scott Gannon claimed Harrelson was with her on the day of the murder, and at least one member of the jury bought it. Harrelson's trial ended in a deadlocked jury, 11 for conviction and 1 for acquittal. Until retrial, Harrelson would remain behind bars. Meanwhile, Pete Scamardo was tried as an accessory to the murder. He was found guilty, but despite the verdict, Scamardo was given just 7 years probation and no jail time.
It was Foreman saying, he's a family man, he's church going, he's never been in trouble with the law. That's exactly what he said. Except for the little murder that he was involved in, he wasn't ever in trouble with the law. He painted him as he's really an honest person. If you let him go, he'll turn his life around. And I guess they bought it, or maybe they were bought. I don't know. But it's inexplicable that you'd hire a guy to kill someone, that person kills someone, and you get no jail time. That's inexplicable. There's no way that a jury can explain how that's correct, how that's proper in any way, shape, or form.
For 3 years, Charles Harrelson sat in the Edinburgh jail, awaiting retrial. This gave the Texas Rangers plenty of time to make damn sure his alibi witness, Louise Scott Gannon, wouldn't be allowed to tell her story on the stand a second time. In the first trial, they believed she had committed perjury. Texas Ranger Jack Dean recalls the retrial.
So he issued a warrant for Louise Scott Gannon, and during the second trial, I carried a warrant in my pocket for her, and she didn't show up to testify in the second trial, so he got convicted.
Harrelson was sentenced to 15 years in prison.
After the trial, the judge dismissed the jury, and as they walked out, they walked behind Harrelson and one of the jurors. We thought he was suspicious. He leaned over to Harrelson and said, I'm sorry, that's the best I could do.
Wait, who said that?
One of the jurors.
The implication here is that this juror was somehow compromised and possibly paid off.
And like I said, I can't remember his name. We talked about investigating him. And
despite this alleged corruption of justice, the prosecutor, Oscar McGinnis, weary from two trials, decided not to investigate the jury tampering.
Oscar said, I'm tired of Harrelson. We got him convicted. He's out of our jailhouse. Let him go.
Wow.
Forget about it.
Wow.
But he said, that's the best I can do. So at least he voted for conviction.
Harrelson would go on to serve only 5 years of that 15-year sentence before he was back out on the street in 1978. A year later, according to the FBI, he would commit his third murder. So what have I learned about Harrelson after investigating his first two alleged murders? Let's look at his modus operandi for those two crimes. In the cases of both Berg and DeGelia, the victims were abducted, brought to remote locations, and shot execution style in the head at close range with small caliber handguns. In both instances, there was an accomplice involved.
As far as I know, he never committed a homicide alone.
And Charles Harrelson seems to have been working collections for bookies and gamblers out of Vegas and taking the odd murder job.
Who do you think he was working for?
I do know that he worked for entities out of Vegas collecting money. He would have been associated with those type of people because that's where the money's at. And Charlie always went where the money was. And he was well suited for collecting.
You think people were scared of him?
Oh, hell yes. Anybody that knew him and he was aggravated with you, you better be scared of him.
So his reputation preceded him?
Yeah. Yeah, everybody knew he was a hitman. And he made glory on it. I mean, he didn't hide it, sort of bask in the sunshine, you know. I just don't think we're smart enough to catch him for everything he did. So I think there's some bodies out there someplace that never got cleared.
Given what I've learned so far, I'm questioning whether Harrelson could have been involved in the higher-profile assassinations he's been tied to. Judge John Wood? President Kennedy? Neither of those murders fit Charles Harrelson's MO, as they were both shot long-range with high-caliber rifles. And allegedly, both were killed by lone gunmen. But what if they weren't?
I got my suspicions about Judge Wood, but don't tell you what you don't know.
What if there's more to all of this than meets the eye? I did a little further digging into the players involved in Harrelson's first alleged murders. Sandra Sue appears to be who she says she was, a woman who fell in love with the wrong guy and found herself in a dangerous situation. But what about Jerry O'Brien Watkins, the man who supposedly met Charles Harrelson in May of 68, and just a month later, he was abetting him in the kidnap and murder of Sam DeGelia? In my research, I found that Watkins was a World War II hero, and that he was busted in 1957 for trying to sell 300 machine guns to Fidel Castro's Cuban rebels. Maybe he wasn't quite the innocent bystander he presented himself to be. My producer Alex and I came across something even more bizarre.
Hello?
Hey, are you recording right now?
I am. What's going on?
I've been doing some research on Jerry O'Brien. I was just making sure that I was looking at the right guy. So I was wondering if O'Brien is with an E or an A.
It is O'Brien with an E.
Okay. I think I may have found something on this guy that you need to see.
What is it? Send it over.
Yeah, I'm going to shoot it your way right now. It's a document, and it's got his name on it. If that document's legit, I imagine it's something.
Oh, wait, I think I got your email. JFK assassination. What the fuck?
The document is dated July 16th, 1960. The title page reads, JFK Assassination System Identification Form. Agency, FBI. Subjects, CIA Liaison Material. Jerry O'Brien Watkins. The body of the document says the following. The subject is serving a 2-year sentence for Federal Firearms Act and Neutrality Act violations. He was interviewed by the Bureau, at which time he furnished information concerning his attendance of a Cuban guerrilla warfare school in 1959. He indicated that espionage and sabotage had been taught at the school, and that he subsequently was assigned to the Department of Investigations of Castro's army. The Bureau has disseminated information to interested agencies, including Central Intelligence Agency, CIA. This document seems to suggest that Jerry O'Brien Watkins received espionage training in Cuba from Castro's army. He was potentially a liaison for the CIA, and in some way, shape, or form, he was looked at as having been involved in the assassination of JFK. In reading this, I'm reminded of a piece of information that the lawyer Danny Sheehan told me about Charles Harrelson when I first began looking into this story.
Charles told me that stuff. He gave me great details about he was smuggling weapons to Castro for the agency in Cuba back in 1958. And he said he was smuggling weapons with Jack Ruby in coordination with the CIA.
So when did Jerry Watkins and Charles Harrelson really meet? Did their relationship actually go back much further than May of 68? And could they possibly have been running guns together? If so, it could call everything into question, including Harrelson's self-proclaimed involvement in the assassination of JFK. Son of a Hitman is a Spotify original production, produced in partnership with Tradecraft Media and in association with High Five Content. The series is written and executive produced by me, Jason Cavanaugh. Our producer and editor is Alex Vespisted, and our associate producer is Deborah Correa. Additional editorial guidance provided by Natalie Robomet. Original music and theme song by Henry Benoit. Post supervisor is Blake Hill. Mixer is Tom Boykin. From Spotify Studios, executive producers are Liz Gately and Erica Clark, and senior producer is Christina Choi. From Tradecraft Media, executive producers are Ash Sarohia and Scott Bernstein. From High Five Content, executive producer is Andrew Jacobs. Many thanks to executive producer Brett Harrelson. Special thanks to Natalie Tella, Robin Hopkins, Jifa Yador, and Denise Holly. Thanks to Tegan Broadwater and Brad Thompson from Tactical Systems Network. Additional research for this episode was provided by Michael Volpe's book, Bullied to Death, Chris Macney's Kafkaesque Divorce. Sandra Sue Attaway passed away a few months after her interview was recorded. Our condolences go out to her surviving family and friends. Thanks for listening.